I want to say a couple things about, you know, I follow Mother's formula. David did closely somewhat too, but he changes around a lot. And I always do say a prayer, and we do a short meditation with music playing. And yeah. Mother didn't play one at the end like I do, but then it was in a house of someone, you know, Bonnie's house. And so what I find with, and I've said this before, but the prayer, opening prayer, is for me always evokes memories of Mother, of course, but that David and Mother both use the prayer. These are ways of, in a ritual sense, bringing our minds to the warm notion of being, of talking about God. And then some of the music I play is a little more schmaltzy than Mother used to, more Christian stuff. Just because my hard drive has a lot of that that I've collected over the years. And now, so I'm talking to myself here, you realize, but it's good to not let the critical mind stand in the way of things, because we have to enter into the world of spirits. And now many people talk about the heart and the mind as being the two opposing things, but spirit is different than that. It touches first the heart, and then it moves into the brain, into the intellect and the mind. But the spirit is closer in the initial first brush with it. It's easier to enter in through the heart. And Master always said the mother is closer than the father, and that's also what he meant there. Anyway, I do things Mother's way, and I find it works the best. Let's say our opening prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Beloved David.
Beloved David.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Into a little music. This was one I played last Sunday.
It can be just I feel the same sweet spirit that I felt oft times before. Surely I can say that I've been with the Lord. Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. I can feel His mighty power and His grace. The hem of His garment, and I can almost see His face, and my heart is overflowing with the fullness of His joy. I can say without a doubt that I've been with
chapter 3. We're continuing on chapter 3. This is a rather long chapter. So we will continue reading and talk. We'll probably do 2 pages here or so. Firmness of moral courage can be obtained by the culture of Yama. The religious forbearances, for namely abstention from cruelty, dishonesty, covetousness, unnatural living, and unnecessary possessions. And by niyama, the religious observances, namely purity in body and mind, cleaning the body externally and internally from all foreign matters, which, being fermented, creates different sorts of diseases in the system, and clearing the mind from all prejudices and dogmas which make one narrow, contentment in all circumstances, and obedience to the holy precepts of the divine personages. Boy, that's India's great contribution. Now, Mother always mentioned the yamas and the niyamas, and this is where she got it, these two here. The yamas are the do's and don'ts. Mother always translated that as. But Sri Yukteswar gives a more precise definition for each of these, and it's very, very interesting to look at. So what is natural
living? Larry, can I just... I had always thought it was the opposite, that the yamas were the do's and the niyamas were the don'ts, just because of how it sounds. But it's the opposite.
I believe so, yeah. Let's see now. Yeah, the niyamas are purity in body, mind cleaning the body externally. Well, it's these are all positive. These are not negative things. If you look at the yamas, they're abstention.
No, it's forbearances, so it's abstinence, not doing things.
Yeah, yeah.
And the niyamas are doing things.
Yeah, so you might be right that your thinking was, I've always thought it was yamas and do's, as do's and don'ts, but it might be don'ts and do's. By niyama. Ah, be darned. Good catch. Want to look into that from the Hindu and Sanskrit point of view and see what's what. To understand what natural living is, it will be necessary to distinguish it from what is unnatural. Living depends upon the selection of food, dwelling, and company. Living depends on the selection of... We always say food, clothing, and shelter. And he's saying... Clothing, not so much. Food and dwelling and company. That's very interesting, to live naturally. To live naturally, the lower animals can select these for themselves by the help of their instinct and the natural sentinels placed at the sensory entrances, namely the organs of sight, smell, and taste. With men in general, these organs, however, are so much perverted by unnatural living from very infancy, that no reliance can be placed on their judgments. To understand, therefore, what our natural needs are, we ought to depend upon observation, experiment, and reason. First, to select our natural food, our observation should be directed to the formation of the organs, which aid in digestion and nutrition, namely the teeth and digestive canal. To the natural tendency of the organs of sense, which guide animals to their food, and to the nourishment of the young. By observation of the teeth, we find that in carnivorous animals, the incisors are little developed, but the canines are of striking length, smooth and pointed to seize the prey. The molars also are pointed. These points, however, do not meet, but fit closely side by side to separate the muscular fibers. In the herbivorous animals, the incisors are strikingly developed. The canines are stunted, though occasionally developed into weapons, as in elephants. The molars are rod-topped and furnished with enamel on the sides only. In the frugivorous, all the teeth are nearly of the same height. Canines are a little projected, conical, and blunt, not intended, obviously, for seizing prey, but for exertion of strength. The molars are broad-topped and furnished at the top with enamel folds to prevent waste caused by their side motion, but not pointed to help in chewing flesh. In omnivorous animals, like bears, on the other hand, the incisors resemble those of the herbivorous. The canines are like those of the carnivorous, and the molars are both pointed and broad-topped to serve a twofold purpose. It's interesting that bears are supposed to be omnivores. Oh, he does say omnivorous, doesn't he? And now if we observe the formation of the teeth in man, we find that these do not resemble those of the carnivorous, neither do they resemble the teeth either of the herbivorous or of the omnivorous. They do resemble exactly those of the frugivorous animals. The resemble inference, therefore, is that...
Reasonable.
Oh, what was I saying?
Resemblable. It's okay.
Yes.
Sometimes printed words look funny.
As soon as you interrupted and said, I looked and it said reasonable to me. Wow, that's weird. Therefore, is that man is frugivorous or fruit-eating animal. Now, observation of the digestive canal. By our observation of the digestive canal, we find that the bowels of carnivorous animals are 3 to 5 times the length of their body, measuring from the mouth to the anus, and their stomach is almost spherical. The bowels of the herbivorous are 20 to 28 times the length of their body, and their stomach is more extended and of compound build. But the bowels of the frugivorous animals are 10 to 12 times the length of their body, and their stomach is somewhat broader than that of the carnivorous and has a continuation in the duodenum serving the purpose of a second stomach. This is exactly the formation we find in human beings. Though anatomy says that the human bowels are 3 to 5 times the length of their body, making a mistake by measuring the body from the crown to the soles instead of from the mouth to the anus, Thus, we can again draw our inference that man is, in all probability, a frugivorous animal. By observation of the natural tendency of the organs of sense, the guideposts to determine what is nutritious and by which all animals are directed to their food, we find that when the carnivorous animal finds a prey, he becomes so much delighted that his eyes begin to sparkle, and he boldly seizes the prey and greedily laps the jetting blood. While on the contrary, the herbivorous animal refuses even his natural food, leaving it untouched if it is sprinkled with a little blood. His senses of smell and of sight lead him to select grass and other herbs for his food, which he tastes most delightfully. Similarly, with the frugivorous animal, we find that their senses always direct them to fruits of the trees and field. In men also, we find that their senses of smell, etc., never lead them to slaughter any animal. On the contrary, they cannot bear even the sight of it. Slaughterhouses are always recommended to be removed far from towns. Men often pass strict ordinances forbidding the uncovered transportation of flesh meats. Can flesh then be styled as the natural food of man, when both his eyes and nose are so much against it? Unless his senses are deceived by cooking with spices, salt, and sugar, etc. On the other hand, how delightful do we find the fragrance of fruits, the very sight of which even makes the mouth water. It may also be noticed that various grains and roots possess an agreeable odor and taste, though faint, even when unprepared. Thus again, we are led to infer from these observations that man was decidedly intended to be a frugivorous animal. And then how we feed our young. By the observation of the nourishment of the young, we find that milk is undoubtedly the food of the newborn babe. Abundant milk is not supplied in the breasts of the mother if she does not take fruits, grains, and vegetables as her natural food. Now we look at causes of disease. Hence, from these observations, the only conclusion that can reasonably be drawn is that various grains, fruits, roots, and, for beverage, milk, and pure water openly exposed to air and sun are decidedly the best natural food for man. These being congenial to the system when taken according to the power of the digestive organs, well chewed and mixed with saliva, are always easily assimilated. Other foods are unnatural to man, and being uncongenial to the system are necessarily foreign to it. When these foods get access to the stomach, they are not properly assimilated. Mixed with the blood, they accumulate in the excretory and other organs not properly adapted to them. When they cannot find their way out, they subside in tissue crevices by the laws of gravitation, and being fermented, produce diseases, mental and physical, and ultimately lead to premature death. Experiment also proves that the non-irritant diet natural to the vegetarian is, almost without exception, admirably suited to children's development, both physical and mental. Their mind, understanding, will, the principal faculties, temper, and general disposition are also properly developed. We find that when extraordinary means such as excessive fasting, scourging, or monastic confinement are resorted to for the purpose of suppressing the sexual passions, these means seldom produce the desired effect. Experiment shows, however, that the man can easily overcome these passions, the arch enemy of morality, by natural living on a non-irritant diet, above referred to. Thereby, they get a calmness of mind, which even every psychologist knows is the most favorable to mental activity and to a clear understanding as well as to a judicial way of thinking. Something more should be said here about the natural instinct of propagation, which is, next to the instinct of self-preservation, the strongest in the sexual desire. Like all other desires, has a normal and an abnormal or diseased state, the latter resulting only from the foreign matter accumulated by unnatural living, as mentioned above. In the sexual desire, everyone has a very accurate thermometer to indicate the condition of his health. This desire is forced from its normal state by irritation of nerves, resulting from the pressure of foreign matter accumulated in the system, which is exerted on the sexual apparatus, and is at first manifested by an increased sexual desire, followed by the gradual decrease of potency. This sexual desire in its normal state makes man quite free from all disturbing lusts and operates on the organism, awaking a wish for appeasement only very infrequently. Here again, experiment shows that this desire, like all other desires, is always normal in individuals who lead a natural life, as mentioned. The sexual organ, the junction of important nerve extremities, particularly of the sympathetic and the spinal nerves, which are the principal nerves of the abdomen, which, through their connection with the brain, are capable of enlivening the whole system, is in a sense the root of the tree of life. Man, well instructed in the proper use of sex, can keep his body and mind in proper health and can live a pleasant life throughout. The practical teachings of sexual health cannot be taught because the public regards the subject as unclean and indecent. Thus blinded, mankind presumes to clothe nature in a veil because she seems to them impure, forgetting that she is always clean and that everything impure and improper lies in man's ideas and not in nature herself. It is clear, therefore, that man, not knowing the proper use of the sexual organ and being compelled to wrong practices by the nervous irritation resulting from unnatural living, suffers troublesome diseases in life and ultimately becomes a victim of premature death. Secondly, about our dwelling place. We can easily understand when we feel displeasure on entering our crowded rooms after breathing fresh air on our mountaintop or in an expansive field or garden, that the atmosphere of the town or any crowded place is quite an unnatural dwelling place. The fresh atmosphere of the mountaintop or of the field or garden, or of a dry place under trees covering a large plot of land and freely ventilated with fresh air, is the proper dwelling place for man according to nature. And thirdly, as to the company we should keep. Here also, if we listen to the dictates of our conscience and consult our natural liking, we will at once find that we favor those persons whose magnetism affects us harmoniously, who cool our system, internally invigorate our vitality, develop our natural love, and thus relieve us of our miseries, and administer peace to us. This to say, we should be in the company of the sat, or savior, and should avoid that of the asat, as described before. By keeping the company of sat, or savior, we are enabled to enjoy perfect health, physical and mental, and our life is prolonged. If, on the other hand, we disobey the warning of Mother Nature without listening to the dictates of our pure conscience and keep the company of whatever has been designated as asat, an opposite effect is produced and our health is impaired and our life shortened. Thus, life, natural living, being indispensable to the practice of yama, the ascetic forbearances explained above, to make any attempt to practice yama without living naturally is altogether useless. Purity of mind and body being equally indispensable to the practice of niyama, the ascetic observance, as explained above, every attempt should be made to attain that purity. Let me just see how much more we've got. This is actually quite good, and it reads like it should be all together. All right, so I'll read a little more here because it seems to be tied together. Firmness of moral courage, when attained, removes all the obstacles in the way of salvation. These obstacles are of eight sorts, namely hatred, shame, fear, grief, condemnation, race distinction, pride of pedigree, and a narrow sense of respectability, which are the meannesses of the human heart. By the removal of these obstacles, magnanimity of the heart comes in, and this makes man fit for the practice of asana, remaining in steady and pleasant posture. Pranayama, control over prana, or the breath, involuntary nerves, and pratyahara, changing the direction of organs, the voluntary nerves, inward. These practices enable man to satisfy his heart by enjoying the object of senses and are intended for domestic life. Vihasasam. Purvasham, I've heard too. Man can put the voluntary nerves into action whenever he likes and can give them rest when fatigued. When all of these nerves require rest, he sleeps naturally, and by the sleep all those voluntary nerves, being refreshed, can work again with full vigor. His involuntary nerves, however, irrespective of his will, are working continuously of themselves since his birth. As he has no control over them, he cannot interfere with their action in the least. When these nerves become fatigued, they also want rest and naturally fall asleep. This sleep of the involuntary nerves is called Mahanidra, the great sleep or death. When this takes place, the circulation, respiration, etc., being stopped, the material body naturally begins to decay. After a while, when this great sleep, Mahanidra, is over, man awakes with all his desires and, finding his body unfit for further work, leaves the same and goes somewhere else to create a new one for the accomplishment of his desires. In this way, man binds himself to life and death and hence fails to get salvation. So this is something Mother said, that people often go to sleep and they wake up and the body is not there. She said this about her husband, about Father Hamilton, that when he died, she sensed him coming awake a few weeks later and waking up and not knowing where he was. And she helped him and directed him to go into the higher planes. Interesting, still attached to the body. But if man can control these involuntary nerves by the aforesaid pranayama, he can stop the natural decay of the material body and put the involuntary nerves to rest at times, as is the case with his voluntary nerves. After this rest, these involuntary nerves also become refreshed and work with a new life again. As after sleep, when full rest has been taken by the voluntary nerves, no help is required to be awakened. So after death also, when full rest has been taken by the involuntary nerves, no help is necessary to be in life again. If man can die, namely put his entire nervous system to rest, controlling the natural decay of the body by the aforesaid pranayama, the nerves then being not much fatigued, life comes into play much sooner than after ordinary death. And the whole system, being refreshed, begins to work with full vigor. Thus life and death come under control. In this manner, man, saving his present body from decay and from the terrible sufferings of death, and requiring no further time for the necessary development of any other material body, can fulfill all the desires of his heart. Thus he is no more required to come into the world under the influence of darkness, Maya, and to suffer again a second death. See Revelations 2, 10 and 11. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. So now we go into Pratyahara and Asanam. So we'll just stop there. And so this has always been an interesting thing for us Westerners, that Sri Yukteswar takes us to task. And of course he's saying this happens in India too. He's not picking on us, but he is definitely saying that we'll be better off in the tropical realms where fruit is fresh, evidently. But he makes a very interesting case. Now, I don't know that it'd be interesting to have a biologist look at this too. You know, I think it makes a good case that our teeth is one really interesting indication. Our canines are flat and small, and we just are so different than most of the other animals, except the frugivorous animals. Now, I believe there are monkeys that are frugivorous, and he probably knows what he's talking about, of course, but that he uses this analysis of the intestines and things like that too. Very interesting. He must have studied this, because he said they made a mistake by measuring from heel to crown of the head when they should have measured from, whereas animals are more laid out that way. Animals are more laid out that way, with the mouth at the starting point of the left, you know, the one side of the body. And animals are horizontal more often than not. And they are an anus at the other end. Whereas, chimps, certainly man, and other ones. They are different in a way that the body is laid out more vertically. So what do we do in the West when we could live in the tropics and have fresh fruits all the time? But man is very adaptable too. Kate and I were listening to a video about alcoholism, and they were saying that when you drink alcohol all the time, your body, your liver actually develops an ability, correct me if I'm right, Kate here, or if I'm wrong, I mean, it develops ability to process things differently, and they can actually pull things out of their what they're ingesting, and it can adapt for the body better accommodating itself to alcohol. You know, it's some people who don't drink. When you do drink, we all hear stories where, you know, and you just go completely bonkers because it hits you so hard, and your liver doesn't like it, and you have a huge reaction to it. Whereas people who drink really are alcoholics, they have adapted to it, and so the body can adapt to things too. That's my excuse for eating meat, I guess. But it is interesting to see this brought up in this book, because it's you know, he's speaking from you know, a guru, a Satguru. Now, was he fully realized? No, he was well studied at that time in his life. He became, you know, this is me thinking, there's evidence of this, that he attained final realization, full realization later in his life. And he wrote this book, though he probably wouldn't have ever said it was incorrect, you know, even as he attained realization. Oftentimes books become less important. So I don't mean to argue with him, but I do know that we have people who live in the Arctic and literally eat only, you know, seal meat and fat and things like that. Now, the question is how his mark of measurement is to see if you if you live a long time, if you live and you also live a good life with all, you know, mental clarity, everything healthy up until the moment of death, you know, at least longer, and not having our long periods of, you know, dementia and stuff that we have in the West. So he's on to something, and his explanations make sense. We all have to make of it what we will. The yamas and niyamas, so I'm so glad you pointed this out, Jill, that it's completely opposite of what I was thinking. Because Mother always said do's and don'ts. Mother wasn't trying to translate each of those words in sequence. She just always called them what we call in the West do's and don'ts, and what they call yamas and niyamas. Another thing she talked about was there was an equivalent to Moses, Manu, or is that what it was? Anyone know? And then so
Manu
Moses,
is the role giver, is Manu.
Yeah, Manu, isn't it? Thank you. So the, you know, Moses was the rule giver. He brought the Ten Commandments down, and has, you know, kind of do's and don'ts. And then in the East they have someone similar. Anybody have a thought on any of this?
The other thing he talked about with meat was the sexual.
Yes, very interesting, yeah. Yeah, let's see. In fact, he spends extra time on that. Now, you know, is it the autobiography where he says that the what happens in the Garden of Eden, this eating of the fruit in the middle of the garden, he says the body is the garden in that analogy, and that the middle of the garden is the sexual organs, and that this is what dooms us to raising children. Now, I've always thought that it's odd that we should probably get the quote out of the Bible, but the women will have to suffer in childbirth. If they didn't before, why didn't they? Even if there wasn't sexual, congress or to gain a child, was the baby not born inside the mother's body? It's so interesting to think about what was being imagined. Of course, we are kind of more taught that it's entering from the astral world into the higher planes, could be the causal plane in the Garden of Eden story. And that... that we, you know, there's a descent into flesh, descent into the human world, and in which only there is sexual organs needed. And the Master and Jesus says that in heaven there are no genders. There's no issues of male and female. That's something necessary in this realm for procreation. So, but still, it does raise the question of, if man didn't have to work by the sweat of his brow before, it makes sense that it's the higher planes that it's coming to, and that he does, and that the woman doesn't have to suffer in childbirth. Kate and I were talking about how it's not just man that suffers in childbirth. She's seen, and I have seen also a calf being born, and my uncle was called out, had to go to the barn and help this one new heifer with her first, and it was quite an ordeal. And he did most of the work, but he had me do ropes and things at different times and help with it. Mostly I got to watch, and it was a very interesting process. But the cow was really having trouble, truly was. So, you know, with humans, you have trouble too. There's a race for the size of the head and the length of the infancy or the gestation. So there's a point where it has to come out. The human baby, though, is not able to stand like the calf is when they're born. The human baby is really still a fetus for several months, in fact. And, you know, when you think about how long it takes to even walk, it's 1 year. Typically for a baby to walk, and then they're called toddlers because they walk like a toddler. They don't walk very efficiently. So many other animals, they walk right away. Now, birds don't. Others exceptions, but still, it's a fairly short time of growth to adulthood for most things, most animals. So, he's saying that pranayama helps with and natural living helps with sexual desire, and that it shouldn't be something that is so insistent that we can't control. He says it is controllable. So we have this modern world that we're living through right now in opposition to so much of what is natural. I like that he says natural living. He's not saying, oh, this is the pure and pristine person. He's saying this is the natural state of man, the body being used correctly, being fed correctly, clean correctly, with it using a good conscience and morality, that these things bring you peace. And so it pacifies all of the nerves, all of the chakras, so to speak, too.
I was back to food, Larry, but I guess it's about all of it. I was thinking in terms of a fruitarian diet, I would think that I just would never find it satisfying. Mm-hmm. But I then started thinking that he's right, that a fresh fruit does smell delicious.
Yeah.
We unfortunately, you know, in our stores very rarely get really fresh fruit. Yeah. And I wonder, and vegetables only smell good when they're being cooked with spices or with something. Mm-hmm. And same with grains. And maybe with milk, a fruitarian diet would be more satisfying because you'd...
You know, Kate, it's interesting. You know, you and I have been buying raw milk every now and then, not all the time, but we do buy it and we do love it. I always, when we first get it, I really love a drink just to have a cup of it. It just smells so good and drinks so well. It's so interesting that I'm drawn to it because normally I don't drink milk at all. I have cereal every now and then. I'll have milk, but most of the time I have other things.
But in a natural state, if we lived in a place in the country or in another country.
And in the tropics, you know, too, because you can't have fruit. Yeah. You can't have fruit year round, you know.
No.
Yeah. Whereas they do in India. They have either cycling through different fruits being ripened. But go ahead, sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it would, if you had wanted to have that kind of a natural life, mm-hmm. you would have to live in a place where you could, where you'd have a ready supply of fresh fruit and of the milk and perhaps some grains.
It is interesting, you know, grains would be one thing you could store, and that's the beauty of perhaps that. But it is interesting, the yogis go up into the Himalayan mountains and in the caves, and what are they fed? Rice and vegetables, you know, no fruits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't doubt that he's describing what this, in the higher yugas, do people live, you know, near the tropics all the time, and people who aren't in the tropics just have to live by different rules, but they explore and do different things in the world. There's a...
If you think of those of us who garden at all, and Larry, you know, having been around fresh or raw milk and making butter and stuff like that, yes, the taste, the smell. But when we garden and we pull the vegetables from the earth, you know, the smell of them, or if we pick berries in that, mm-hmm. what we do get to pick in the Pacific Northwest. And then even thinking of fish and seafood, which is more plentiful because we're, you know, we're all by the water here, unless we're inland. And you think of the smell and how that translates into stimulating our senses to be prepared to enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, in fact, I thought you were going to say about vegetables, you know, when the smell of chlorophyll and the smell of each of the different, I've been so enamored of like mint that Kate grows and different, and dill. And I was thinking, you know, it's growing in the same ground. And the only difference is the whatever magic is in the seed, because these are really very different. And oh, there's so many spices and things like that grow in the same ground. How magical that all is, but boy, are they ever lovely smelling. All of them are. You know, if you go to beans and, what's the one we just had the other day? And broccoli and cauliflower, those, they don't have much smell, but they're very nice. And usually with adding things to them. But by themselves, eating them raw, fruits, about the only thing you could imagine doing a lot of, and even then, it's difficult to imagine doing that completely.
So an Ayurvedic practitioner that I worked with one time said that it's about digestion of food, but she said it's actually what you extract out of the food that assimilates.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's something to the fruit, because it's easily assimilated in the juice that you're getting the life.
Yeah. You're getting everything you need. Yeah. And your body, it does make sense that the fruit would be something. I mean, look at the difference between fruit that's not ripe and ones that are ripe. Ripe ones melt in your mouth. I mean, it's not just saying something, it's, or you know, making it, it's like it melts. No, literally, they melt in your mouth. Yeah, so interesting. But this is
when things,
go ahead.
When things are fresh, you can feel that. I think you can feel that energy if you're a relatively clean eater, not overly spiced, etc. You could feel that coming into the body. So like the Ayurvedic work, you can feel that nutrition entering into the body. You can feel that difference. Is, you know, you're not feeling heavy afterwards. You feel lighter and refreshed and rejuvenated.
I was just going to say, Larry, that for the last couple of weeks, Ricky and I have been kind of on a diet with, well, for his liver, no salt. Wow. And that's huge for me.
That is, yeah, no kidding.
And lots of vegetables. And so it's nice. I feel very inspired to just not worry about spicing up my food now so much, you know. I'll take all these spices out, everything but salt. And it's like, why bother? You know, why not get into more purity
It's interesting that India uses spices in everything. They would never just have broccoli by itself. I've always used that as an example. They would look askance at us for just having broccoli steamed. It seems it would be, you just would never see an Indian do that in their home. But go ahead, sorry.
I was also going to say, you know, you got me thinking about the value of saying grace, because you're asking for the food to be blessed, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah.
So it makes grace important and valuable.
Well, it brings you single-mindedness on God. It brings you back. Whatever we can do to bring our minds back to God too. But yes, I'm sure you're right that there, grace, saying grace and having, you know, just a short meditation sets your mind into a better state to digest and to enjoy the food.
Mm-hmm. I really love this. I'm surprised that Sri Yukteswar talks about these things. It really took me by surprise.
Yeah. It's a short book, but there's a ton. There's just a ton of interesting stuff here.
Yeah, I was going to say also, not very long ago, I read that something as simple as, they usually say when a little baby is around 6 months old, you can start feeding them solid food.
Mm-hmm.
But then what I discovered recently was that the baby has to be able to chew the food. That's the natural thing. So you don't give the baby food until they have teeth to chew it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Or you mash it up for them. I mean, a lot of birds chew things up and you know, expel it out of their mouth for their babies. They're pre-digesting it. So, yeah, it's not crazy that we mash things up for babies. But, yes, teeth are designed to come in, you know, in their natural time. So it does look like it's for later. Well, I mean, I think many societies, they nurse babies, you know, for well into 2 or 3 years. One thing, it helps with getting pregnant too. There's some evidence of that, I know. So in the natural state, run by a great master in the higher yugas, we probably can witness this life that he's pointing out here.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. This is just really, really nice. I'm thrilled to hear this.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, this is something that we've all talked about, and David and I certainly, but I mean, everybody talks about when they read the Holy Science. When we first did this in the 70s, or at least when I first did it. I'm not sure about David because he met Mother a couple of years before I did. And he was so steeped in all these teachings, you know. And so I never knew for sure when. You know, one thing I do remember, just as point of interest, was when he read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you know, that book transported him. It really did. That's all he talked about for quite a while. And and I remember that being the first time that he'd read that. He referred to it a lot the rest of his life. Dangerous book.
That might have to be the next project.
Well, it's also interesting to think that someone who maybe has, great sexual desire and doesn't do well as a celibate or doesn't do well as somebody who lives in moderation or a more natural state, as he would say,
mm-hmm.
is that it sounds like what he's saying is that undigested food or heavy food or food that is not fresh.
What does he say?
Become putrid and fermented.
Fermented, that's the word he uses, yeah.
And then that presses on the nerves and creates that kind of...
Well, you have a septic system, septic kind of thing going on. Well, diverticulitis is what he's talking about, isn't it? And, you know, my sister Debbie has colitis, but they found a pocket in her colon or near her colon, her large intestine, a fold that was probably goes back to her birth. And that was a place that was kept catching things all the time. And they did surgery and she got rid of it, but she still has a difficult time with, you know, kind of, her colitis is much better since then, but she almost died during that operation too.
But just if that is the case, that's very interesting to think about that kind of heavy living that we often do in terms of our eating. I mean, all of us eat too much. Mm-hmm. And that if that is the one of the causes of constant sexual pressure that some people feel.
Yeah. He's making that case for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Natural living. He's explaining sex as a different kind of thing than what we know in the modern world today. So I've been, you know, investigating a lot of things between men and women lately, and it does seem that these kind of animal sides to sex are, like, for instance, there's the famous thing is hypergamy is the big word of interest to everybody because it explains dating problems and all this. So, you know, the ideal from the Jews too have the ideal that every man should be married, and that, you know, the idea that you would all of the, you know, like the 60-80% of women are only interested in the top men, you know, this that's because of an unnatural state, because they're not even evaluating on proper terms a proper mate for their level of, you know, a person. Instead, they're looking to the highest. And so the idea that we should each have a mate, everybody should have they have a right to having a mate, is really, I think, really good for all of society. But it also reflects a higher type of society where you don't, you know, we always have kings and chiefs and people like that who have 4 and 10 wives. And you know, that occurs because of the martial world and the fighting and having to have a castle and one person being more productive than anybody else and whatever all the stories were. When we have a much more balanced society, there's a mate for everyone. There's no reason for the king, if there is probably still a leadership in the king, that he's going to be more like Rama. Rama told Sita that my father had 3 wives, but I will only have you. I will only have you as my wife. And that the Indians, you know, they have a strong desire to have everyone get married. It's a rite of passage. And a rite of, well, in the Jewish tradition, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not considered a full adult in the synagogue until you're married. That's the final, the bar mitzvah is part of it. That's acknowledging your physical and you have to do intellectual things too. You have to read something and say it properly and show that you're educated in the Torah or the, whatever it is, Talmud too, but I think it's the Torah that they do. And then later on, though, the next step is to get married. And for a woman, this is Joseph Campbell points out that when menstruation starts, that is her bat mitzvah. He didn't say bat, but that's her entry into a woman to adulthood. And men do an artificial. You know, men have to be controlled by society, so they have societal rituals, and whereas women have natural ones. And so he was saying that. Men are the ones that have to spend more time, you know, channeling their energies and their all of their powers into something that's proper for society. And one of the best things you can do is to give a man a wife and children. And we always forget that's what a wife is for, that's what marriage is for. But that children will drive a man to do extraordinary things for all of society, because everyone benefits when people are well employed and not causing trouble in the streets, of course. And that's what happens. You have one or the other, but children is the means by which we civilize men. And we have the great societies that we have in history in this, and for mankind. That's the method that works best for sure. And we're so far from that now. So far, very sad. So many men are left childless.
Things too is that, you know, when you talk about women to select for a mate, is men are designed within their DNA that the higher the bar is set for them, the harder that they must work to achieve, to meet that bar. And today we have lowered the bar so much. And the complacency, so...
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, yeah. But that's because I still would maintain that's because they can't compete in the DNA sweepstakes, you know, they can't compete. If you're in the lower half of men, well, you know, historically, there is evidence that historically men have always, only 50% of the men have their genes go to the next generation, whereas women, about 80 to, well, probably more like 90%. I'm talking about, you know, 100 years ago or more, you know, more natural, more recent, more historical terms. Evidently, you know, when you look at the gene pool, the genes that are pass forward, or like only 50% of the men contribute genes to the next pool. Now, see, this is good because if you think about it from a nature and DNA point of view, evolution point of view, women are trying to hypergamy. They're trying driven to get have mates or have relations with a higher quality DNA person. So, I mean, however that is determined, they're driven to look for someone taller, stronger, smarter, or equivalent, same height, but they almost always want taller and stronger. But intelligence is often, you look for a good match on that. All of that kind of stuff drives the genome to produce better children. So it's a twist. But see, when I think the overlay of a good religion is to get everyone married. So that's I think that's what's going on, as to get to the higher societies that produce the most and do the best for all people in the society.
Oh, I'm sorry, I have my audio on, but I suppose in the past, you'd have a certain percentage of men who would die in warfare, a certain percentage as of in dangerous circumstances, or they were, you know, they're either careless or they had to do some kind of activity that would kill them off. And then you have women dying in childbirth. So, but certainly you had the excess men, and they were usually used up with warfare. And nowadays, if we've got excess men, they're just not passing, you know, they're not getting married because women usually have somebody else to go for. And yeah. So you have a lot of the guys that are on the bottom of society for whatever reason, who don't aren't able to mate up.
Yeah.
It seems that relationships are, we can casually discard them. If we don't like you today, that's okay, we'll go get something else. That sense of commitment, because we haven't learned how to make that union and work together to overcome, which gives us that strength to participate in everything else.
Yeah, it's a very sad state of affairs, and it's getting worse, it seems like, too. It is, yeah. You know, it's something that's worried me and bothered me for a long time. And there's, first of all, there's so much more data available nowadays, and a lot of people studying this. You know, our birth rate, everything is all driven by this low testosterone, values too. So it's all of a piece. And God's working hard on it, I'm sure. He's bringing about this. All this technology has brought about a new world, and we just don't know what to do with all of these baubles, all of these distractions. So we'll have to. You know, the physical plane is not a place for peace in these yugas. It's just we can't expect it. We can become a yogi, we can become better at it than others, but we can't expect most of mankind to not be, or to be in the same state and desiring peace and know and associated with the teaching that will give you some of that, give you a direction to go. It's 8:30.
Everybody is comfortable with the state of peace. I observe around me some individuals that state of chaos, because that peacefulness or that quiet or that stillness is extremely uncomfortable for them.
Exactly.
Very uncomfortable.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's people who like chaos, you know, they actually prefer, that's what they came down here for. I think their souls, you know, David used to talk about this, you know, from, forget his name, but, you know, Scott, whatever, not Donald Scott, but anyway, that he said there's four stages of man. One is chaos, happily so. And then there's a second stage where people don't want chaos and they choose a very fundamentalist religion or way of living, very rigid. and they to stay away, to get out of the chaos and have their, because especially children who were raised in a chaotic thing, when they grow up, they don't want it. And then the third stage, they move into the state of no dogmatism. They stop worrying about, you know, all the rules, and they still operate from a high principle. So they don't need the rules, and they work on that level. And then the fourth stage is similar to the second stage and can be viewed that way. Sometimes people, because it's usually, the fourth stage is to add religion and to teach religion and to have the higher forms of religion that that people in the third stage, this is David talking, so I mean, I hope I remember it well. People in the third stage see fourth stage people like second stage people, very dogmatic and rigid. And then when you actually talk to them, they, you know, a third stage person can see, oh no, there is a difference here. What? And then that's where you hope that they then want to become like that, to say, oh, this is a difference. And they have peace, but they're not dogmatic and they're not dismissive and they're not cruel. They are what the higher man should be. But they, the fourth stage, they teach from the point of the unseen world. They teach of religion and they talk about it, but they're not doing it from the second stage level. They're doing it from a higher, a free point, a freedom, a freed while living. Jivan Mukta is the ideal. Well, it's good to go through this book. I think it's something that people on this path need to be aware of, as I've said before. What's here?
Go ahead. As an optimistic aspect to all the chaos and everything, David's quote for today is, there is no substitute for the hard work of changing one's own life in order for this world to change. So when the world feels chaotic, that the job starts at home.
Yeah. In fact, you can't have anything lasting without it coming from within. It's true. It's got to be all the way through, inwardly and outwardly consistent. Let's say Mother's closing prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Thank you, Larry. Hari Om.
Hari Om. I'm going to play a little music, but we'll see you next time.
Yes, please.
Hari Om.